ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the President of Nauru makes a secretive visit to Parliament House in Canberra amid concerns about his country's deal to accept Australian immigration detainees. Also, we mark the 50th anniversary of the dismissal of the Whitlam government. And in Western Australia, the discovery of a new native bee.
It had devil-like horns on the clypeus, which is the front of the bee's face. And so I was like, this is an undescribed species, I'm sure.
First this evening, the President of Nauru, David Adiang, has made an unannounced visit to Parliament House in Canberra. The seemingly clandestine stop comes after allegations criminal bikie gangs have been awarded a lucrative contract to provide security services for Australian immigration detainees who've been transferred to Nauru. Less than a fortnight ago, the first members of what are known as the NZYQ cohort were quietly sent there. Most of that group had their Australian visas cancelled because of criminal convictions, but they had to be released from immigration detention because the High Court ruled their indefinite incarceration was illegal. The ABC's foreign affairs correspondent, Stephen Jedgetts, is following the story. Stephen, why is this visit of the President of Nauru to Canberra so intriguing?
Well, Sam, it's intriguing for a couple of reasons. The first is that the visit comes at a time when there's an awful amount of controversy about Australia's relationship with Nauru, and specifically over the NZYQ cohort. Now, as listeners know, there's an agreement with Australia which will see Australia pay substantial amounts of money to Nauru in return for Nauru's resettling people from this cohort of detainees and former detainees. But there have been some explosive allegations that were aired just over the weekend by the Nine newspapers about the fact that bikie gangs were allegedly contracted as part of this to provide security for detainees. Now, on top of that, we've also seen just a couple of weeks ago the first members of that cohort, around five in total, moved to Nauru under that plan. So there's an awful lot of interest in the relationship. Now, there's no suggestion that this visit by Mr. Adiang was directly caused by any of these controversies, and the government, at least privately, is quick to hose down any suggestion that they were in any way hauling him in. But obviously, any meetings that are happening between senior members of the government, when you've got all of these sensitive issues circling, are going to draw a lot of interest. We're told that Mr. Adiang met today with Tony Burke, the Home Affairs Minister. That hasn't been publicly confirmed yet by either side, but we have asked for more information, and hopefully we'll be able to learn, for example, whether there was any discussion about these allegations that have been circulated by Nine about the contracting of security guards connected with bikie gangs, or whether there are any further discussions about how many more people through the NZYQ cohort might make their way to Nauru soon.
It seems this visit really has Canberra and observers buzzing. Has the opposition or other politicians in Parliament had anything to say about this visit of the President of Nauru on the quiet?
Well, we have heard from Andrew Wallace, the Shadow Attorney General. He said it's unacceptable that this meeting was kept secret, saying there should be more transparency about what's happening. The Greens have similarly said that the government should explain why the visit hadn't been publicly announced. Now, it is fair to say that there are a lot of visits to Australia, including sometimes official ones, that aren't always announced. I'm told, for example, that the President was at a public event in Parliament yesterday, as well as at another public event held in connection with a Pacific security meeting last night. Nonetheless, I think the fact that the government chose not to flag these meetings at such a sensitive time is inevitably going to draw a level of criticism, particularly from those who say that this whole process around the NZYQ cohort and the resettlement has not been done with sufficient transparency.
So what do you think might happen next?
Well, look, we've asked multiple ministers for more information about what these meetings have covered and exactly what was raised. Hopefully that will give us a better idea of exactly what was or wasn't discussed. I suspect the government will be keen to dispel any notion that there was anything extraordinary about these meetings. But as I say, given the nature of what's happened, given the controversy that's been around, particularly given the allegations in the weekend, a level of scrutiny and a level of questioning about what is being discussed here is inevitable.
Stephen Jedgetts is the ABC's foreign affairs correspondent. Well, this time 50 years ago, Australians were reeling from the news that the Governor-General had sacked the Labor Prime Minister Gough Whitlam and his government. Sir John Kerr's momentous decision came after a weeks-long deadlock that saw the opposition blocking the government's supply or money bills and Mr Whitlam refusing to go to an early election. The 1975 dismissal, as it's come to be known, remains the one and only time the monarch's representative has removed Australia's elected Prime Minister and government, and debate still rages about the actions of Sir John Kerr. Rachel Mealy prepared this report.
As the events of the 11th of November 1975 unfolded in Canberra, Australians tuned in to hear the news.
This special news bulletin from the ABC is read by Peter Young. Mr Whitlam has been dismissed by the Governor-General and Mr Malcolm Fraser will become caretaker Prime Minister of Australia pending a general election.
The freshly minted Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, informed the Parliament.
Mr Speaker, this afternoon the Governor-General commissioned me to form a government until elections can be held.
Order! Order!
While Gough Whitlam stood on the front steps of the Parliament and spoke to the crowds that had gathered.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen.
God save the Queen!
Because nothing will save the Governor-General.
When Gough Whitlam made his famous speech that day, he was flanked by Paul Keating, who had been appointed as a junior minister in the Whitlam government only weeks prior. The then 31-year-old Paul Keating says he advised Gough Whitlam to replace Sir John Kerr as the Governor-General.
My proposition was that Gough should ask the Queen to accept his advice about the appointment of a new Governor-General. And in the event that Kerr resisted, I said to Gough I thought he should be put under police arrest.
In an interview recorded to mark the 50th anniversary of the dismissal, Paul Keating admitted that taking that course of action would have been risky.
I said the only thing you'd have to be sure about Gough is, of course, Kerr is technically the Commander-in-Chief, that the soldiers, that is the Chief of the Defence Force, do not end up in a fight with the police. In other words, you'd have to have the soldiers with you for this to happen. But then what would happen is you would then make a recommendation. The Queen could accept your recommendation. But I said, I think in all of that, you then have to go to a general election.
History tells the tale, but Paul Keating says Gough Whitlam wasn't inclined to take his advice.
He said, Thank you, you know all, for that advice. Thank you for your know all that advice. But you see, he wasn't of a mind to take the advice. He was a constitutionalist, Gough, you know. He wasn't into blood and gore, you know. He was a constitutionalist.
Australians of all political persuasions have remembered where they were when they heard the news of the dismissal. The former Prime Minister, John Howard, was a junior shadow minister.
I was inside the House of Representatives chamber and the bells had begun ringing at 2:10. I approached the then chief opposition whip and he said, Kerr has sacked Gough. And I looked at him rather incredulously. I said, you can't be serious. He said, yes, I am. I remember it very clearly.
He says Whitlam's government served to teach future Australian governments to run a tight ship.
In the end, he ran a chaotic government. And the ultimate test when you're in that game is to succeed in government. Not much good succeeding in opposition, if you blow it all when you get into government.
Australia's current Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, agrees.
Look, there's no doubt that the Whitlam government made mistakes. Its internal processes were dysfunctional. You had ministers going into the caucus arguing against positions that the ministry, the cabinet had taken. You had a range of scandals. The loans affair reflects very badly on everyone involved in it. And so I think it is a matter of making sure that government should be orderly, should be considered, proper processes were put in place.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. Rachel Mealy with that report. As the 2028 Los Angeles Summer Olympics draw closer, the International Olympic Committee is debating whether it'll allow transgender athletes to compete at the event. A few months ago, the committee, led by President Kirsty Coventry, decided it would set the eligibility criteria for athletes rather than leaving it to individual sports federations. And there's growing speculation among observers the Olympic body will take a hardline approach to protect the rights of female athletes. Diana Damjanovic filed this report.
We already play on the world stage.
The excitement is building for the 2028 Los Angeles Olympics.
In 2028, when we welcome the Games, we'll show the world the real LA.
And there appears to be a shift in policy at the top of the International Olympic Committee when it comes to transgender athletes. Nothing's been confirmed yet, but the committee appears set to effectively ban them from the Games. Professor Ada Chung is the head of the Trans Health Research Group at the University of Melbourne.
I think it's very important that, you know, for trans women in particular competing in elite international competition, there needs to be eligibility criteria. There needs to be some parameters about how long someone needs to be on gender-affirming hormone therapy in order to reduce any male advantage.
Under the current rules, transgender athletes are still eligible to take part in the Olympics. Only a handful have ever taken part in the Games. But in September, the new IOC president, Kirsty Coventry, set up the Protection of the Female Category Working Group to look into, in her words, how to best protect the female category in sports. The IOC has now confirmed an update was given to committee members last week. It says discussions are continuing and further information will be provided at the appropriate time. Nikki Dryden is an Olympic swimmer and human rights lawyer. She says it's too early to make assumptions around what the IOC's final decision will be.
So it's very disappointing to see news stories coming out that the IOC might be making a decision on gender inclusion prematurely. They did indicate that they would take their time. They have created working group, although I disagree with the fact that the working group is not transparent. They have indicated that they would be taking their time to look at all the issues. So I don't know if it's just journalists jumping the gun and trying to get the headline story. But hopefully they aren't ready to make a decision and they are taking their time over what is a very complex decision.
Until now, the IOC has allowed the governing bodies of each sport to make its own rules around trans athletes at the Games. But in June, under the new president, Kirsty Coventry, it did a U-turn by deciding to take the lead itself in setting eligibility criteria. Professor Ada Chung.
Everybody should have the opportunity to participate in sport, and the ability to participate in sport is a human right, but there needs to be eligibility criteria. There needs to be eligibility criteria to enable trans people to meaningfully participate in sport. And the science supports that. But the problem at the moment is that there's a broader political narrative. Sport's highly visible. It's emotionally charged. And it's often tied to old ideas about gender.
At the 2021 Tokyo Olympics, New Zealand weightlifter Laurel Hubbard became the first openly transgender athlete to compete in a different gender category than that assigned at their birth. She was eligible under IOC-issued guidelines allowing any transgender athlete to compete as a woman, provided their testosterone levels are under 10 nanomoles per litre for at least 12 months before their first competition. The future of trans people at the next Olympic Games has also been under threat from the US president, with Donald Trump saying he would not allow transgender athletes to compete at the Los Angeles Games. Nikki Dryden says when people talk about trans athletes having an unfair advantage, their views are often misplaced.
And there are so many other things that create unequal playing fields for people around the world, and most of them have to do with economic advantage. So growing up in a country like Australia, most athletes have all the economic advantages, including prior hosting of an Olympic Games is actually a benefit. So these are the types of things that create competitive advantage, not things like transgender women in sport.
Nikki Dryden is an Olympian and human rights lawyer. That report from Diana Damjanovic. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, a devilish new native bee discovered in WA. Hungarian-British author David Szolai has taken home the prestigious Booker Prize for Fiction with his novel Flesh. Among the other authors shortlisted for the coveted literary award were Susan Choi, Andrew Miller and Kiran Desai. Kimberly Price has this report.
The storyline of David Szolai's novel Flesh takes readers from a housing estate in Hungary to combat in the Iraq War before rubbing shoulders with the elite in England, as it charts the life of a quiet loner, Istvan. It's described as a dark but humorous story, and now it's been awarded the prestigious 2025 Booker Prize. Previous winner Roddy Doyle was one of the judges this year. He explains their decision.
But as we discussed them, there was one book that we kept coming back to, one book in particular that made us all, and I watched this as it happened, sit up and smile. One book that we felt should win because of its utter singularity. The winner of the 2025 Booker Prize is Flesh.
Hungarian-British author David Szolai didn't expect his book to make an impression with the judges.
I remember Hannah Weston, my editor at Jonathan Cape in London, when we were talking about the title of the book maybe a year ago, wondering aloud whether she could imagine a novel called Flesh winning the Booker Prize. Which speaks to something risky about the title, which we felt at the time, I think, and something risky about the book itself in some ways, or unusual, certainly. Anyway, Hannah, you have your answer, I guess.
In Flesh, a violent act changes the course of Istvan's life, and it's that type of risky writing that keeps David Szolai motivated.
I think fiction can take risks. I think it's one of the things that it can do. It can take aesthetic risks, formal risks, perhaps even moral risks, which many other forms, narrative forms, can't quite do to the same extent. I think part of the reason for that is just that novels are so relatively cheap to produce.
Claire Nichols is the host of Radio National's The Book Show.
There is sex and death in the first chapter, and it really goes from there. It's a fascinating book. It follows the life of this man, Istvan. We meet him as a teenager growing up in Hungary. He's living in a little apartment with his mother, and he's groomed by his upstairs neighbour, this woman who embarks on this sexual relationship with him. And from there, we're going to follow Istvan through a life where a lot of stuff is going to happen to this man.
She believes David Szolai's writing presents readers with a new way of thinking and understanding of the protagonist Istvan.
We always see him from this kind of physical perspective. He is something that things happen to. And when you consider the fact that novels are usually about the interior experience of a character, their thoughts and feelings, this book is fascinating because it is not that. This is about a very physical life. These characters are bodies first. And it really does kind of live up to that title of Flesh.
While the novel doesn't shy away from tough subjects, Claire Nichols accepts its sparing use of dialogue may not suit everyone, but she says it's worth a read.
I do think that Flesh is a novel that benefits from being reread. I think there's new things to find in it. And I think, as I say, there's lots to admire in the challenge that this author has set for himself in writing this very bare novel about this very physical character. I think it must have been a really exciting choice for the judges to make.
This year, actress and publisher Sarah Jessica Parker was chosen to sit on the judging panel, a choice Claire Nichols found interesting.
I think that's really been the big talking point about this panel of judges this year, everyone imagining what those conversations must have been like between these literary people and this Hollywood superstar. So it's fascinating to think what those conversations must have been like in the room. But they have said that this was a unanimous decision for Flesh.
Since the Booker Prize was founded in 1969, it has established a reputation for transforming writers' careers with its $100,000 Australian dollar prize money.
That report from Kimberly Price and Julia Bergen. In Western Australia, a scientist is thrilled with her discovery of a new species of native bee. Its devil-like black horns and a favourite TV show have prompted her to name it the mega chili Lucifer. The female bee was found during a survey of a rare wildflower, and Dr. Kit Prendergast is hoping her find will raise awareness of the need to protect native bees. Isabel Masali has more.
Dr. Kit Prendergast's work as a native bee scientist takes her in all kinds of directions. In 2019, she was in the Bremer Ranges in WA's goldfields for a critically endangered plant. She was surveying its various pollinators. That's insects such as bees.
There was this mallee, a small eucalyptus species in bloom, and it was incredible. I've never seen so many insects and native bees. The air was humming.
And then she came across a distinctive bee, unlike anything she'd ever seen.
It had devil-like horns on the clypeus, which is the front of the bee's face. And there are some other megachili bees in the subgenus Hacuriapis that have structures on their face, but none of them were like this bee. And so I was like, This is an undescribed species, I'm sure. So I then did some detective work. I managed to get some grants to DNA barcode the bee.
That process helped confirm the species didn't match any known bees in DNA databases or in museum collections. It also revealed this bee's partner was collected during the survey, but the male didn't have any horns. Dr. Prendergast says usually in the animal kingdom, it's the other way around. Now, the Curtin University adjunct researcher has published her findings.
This new bee species I called Megachili Lucifer because of the devil-like horns. And in Latin, Lucifer means a light bringer. And I wanted to bring to light, you know, the issues facing our native bees, including lack of recognition, many undescribed species, you know, very few threatened plant species having their pollinators assessed. And I also do really love the Netflix show Lucifer. So if Tom Ellis is listening, I hope he's very happy.
While many scientists dream of getting to name a species, Dr. Prendergast has done this once before. She named the previous discovery after her dog Zephyr.
It's really exciting because I know that there are so many undescribed species of native bees in Australia, and being able to give a species a name means that it now can get some recognition, be better studied, hopefully protected, and raise awareness about this species.
It's always exciting when there's a new bee species discovered and described.
That's Dr. Megan Howcroft, the president of the Australian Native Bee Association and the founder of Australian Pollinator Week, which is on now.
So there's about 1,750 described species of native bee in Australia, but it's estimated that there's at least another 500 or more either haven't been discovered or that specimens are sitting in museums waiting for funding for somebody, a taxonomist to try and describe that bee. And if we don't give things a name, they don't really have a place in our world. And if you don't give them a place in the world, then people won't consider them important.
And while Dr. Prendergast says it's exciting that a new species has been described,
we need to make sure that we protect it, because we don't want it to be, you know, discovered and then lost to extinction. You know, every single species that's evolved is irreplaceable. And there's a lot of media attention about honeybees and honeybee declines. But the reality is that honeybees aren't at risk of extinction. And in Australia, they're an introduced species and they can actually threaten our native bees through competition. So we really need to invest in greater research, conservation, monitoring and awareness of our Australian native bee species.
Dr. Kit Prendergast from Curtin Uni. That report from Isabel Massali. Thanks for joining me for PM this Remembrance Day. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. 3 hours of free electricity in the middle of the day sounds pretty good. But is the federal government's latest solar offer going to reduce hefty power bills? Or is there a catch? Today, energy expert from the Grattan Institute, Alison Reeve, unpacks the ups and downs of the scheme. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.